Thanks for joining me, Steve Hadley, for another exciting and informative edition of the Breaking Ground podcast. Stay with me as I explore the world of basements and underground structures.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Today's episode is about the basement and underground structures and instrumentation and monitoring conference that was recently held at Park Plaza in Vauxhall by Ground Engineering magazine. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined by three of the presenters at that event. Demetrios Solomentis from AKT2, who's their technical director. We've got Graham Webb, an associate from WSP, and Alice Berry, who is an associate at ARUP. And what I'm going to do is explain a little bit about what the event was about, what was going on, and explore a little bit about each of the presenters' presentations at the event and some of the key themes. So as the title might suggest, it was around basements and underground structures. And I think it's a really important time to be involved in geotechnics. There's a lot going on. And in fact, one of the early presentations was by Knight Frank, who are an estate agent, and they were talking about the number of actually high-rise structures. But of course, those high-rise structures tend to come with deep basements as well. And they were explaining that there was double the amount of high-rise buildings, which is defined as anything over 20 stories, compared to 10 years ago. So clearly, there's a lot going on. There's going to be a lot of deep piles, deep basements, and add to that all of the stuff that's happening in terms of our route to zero carbon, much more of which later. Now, I'm really excited about this particular podcast because we've got three really excellent guests on who really know their stuff, and there's a lot of synergy between them as well. So I'm going to really enjoy hearing the conversation. First of all, I'm going to come to Demetrios because, well, he was the first presenter I heard at the event, but also I think he's going to go easy on me because he also used to work in the piling industry. So, Demetrios, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I moved into consultancy from the dark side.
Well, I'm not sure I could call it the dark side, but yeah, there's a few of us that have gone backwards and forwards, and you'll always be a friend to the violin industry.
Thank you.
And your presentation, I found it really compelling. Your focus was, well, let's read out the title. It might take a while, actually. Challenging design practices and using substructure digital twins to improve basement design. I think the key takeaway for me from it was understanding more about how we should design foundations. You had quite a contrasting idea to the status quo. So you spoke about SOF instead of SOS. Do you want to just explain your thought process there?
Sure. I think the whole idea was that historically we have been designing foundations based on a factor of safety approach, and that is related to dealing with the risk of the ground conditions and to try to indirectly capture the serviceability performance of a foundation. But nowadays we have more sophisticated tools to actually predict the performance, the serviceability of foundations. So perhaps it would be more meaningful in the industry if we start talking about the settlement of foundations. So that is the SOF concept rather than the FOS, factor of safety. But the only obstacle we have in terms of moving towards a more performance-driven approach is being able to capture all this great monitoring data we're getting from our basements and being able to validate our numerical models and our designs. And in order to do this, we just need to agree as an industry on a standard format of capturing that monitoring data and being able to actually use that monitoring data to validate our numerical models almost on a real-time basis, which will require some investment in automation and calibration of numerical models and developing these digital platforms. So it was more about capturing some of the lessons learned on how we can improve on our design practices, how we can challenge existing design practices. We need to recognize that everything now is so much more complex. And what actually matters in geotechnics is more the serviceability performance rather than the ultimate limit state. And if we are to move towards this performance-driven approach, then monitoring data is the key. And we just need to agree on the format of the monitoring data and be able to develop these tools that will allow us to get the benefit of all the monitoring data.
Yeah, so that's particularly applicable to retaining walls, isn't it? If we come back maybe to look at the bearing pile elements, and you're talking about prediction of settlements. That was an interesting graph you put up with various different predictions for the settlement. And you said how much more accurate a group of engineers would be in predicting how much a pile is going to move compared to what the ultimate capacity is, which when I thought about it, I thought, well, that's really obvious. But nobody has really spoken too loudly about that in the past. And I wonder what scope as engineers with the current codes of practice we have for employing the sort of methodology you're talking about currently.
I think this is a direction that I'm really interested in my personal journey in terms of improving the status of pile design, in that we should really be focusing more on the on the serviceability condition. And the graph I showed in the conference was about the recent pile test, where there were 8 different predictions from 8 different engineers on the actual load versus displacement response. And what was apparent from the comparison between the actual test data and the prediction was that there was so much difference in the prediction of the ultimate limit state. But when it came to predicting the settlement at the serviceability limit state, the predictions were actually quite good. But it's only when we reached the failure that there was a big difference between the predictions. And yet, as an industry, we're still relying on the prediction of an ultimate limit state in order to derive what is our allowable safe working load with the use of parcel factors. So I think what I would say in response to your question is that we still need to satisfy codes of practice, but at the same time, we need to look at what is the actual serviceability limit condition. And in most of the complex basements and pile groups and pile-assisted rafts, it's the prediction of settlement that is actually the driver in the design rather than an ultimate limit state. And I think we just need to spend more time as an industry, just talking about stiffness rather than strength, invest more in site investigation for measuring the stiffness of soil, and also spend more time and resources in capturing the monitoring data showing us the settlement of the foundations. Because the ultimate limit state is just a philosophical concept. I mean, on the first page of John Berland's thesis, there was this so important statement that stress is philosophical, displacement is reality. And I think after all these years, this is so true. And this is what we should all be focusing as an industry.
So you mentioned there about better SI. What recommendations would you have if you're designing an SI? Because I think a lot of the time we tend to correlate, let's say, a a triaxial result. You're correlating a cohesion based on some empirical value to get to a Young's modulus. What sort of lab tests or in situ tests have we got to directly measure the Young's modulus, for instance, or the consolidation of soil sample?
I think that's an important area of focus, and there have been some developments, obviously, in the site investigation industry with the self-boring pressure meter. So being able to replicate the actual stiffness of the soil in situ as much as possible, that would have to be the overall aim, trying to understand the development of stiffness in the soil as a function of the stress history, and being able to validate our numerical models using a stiffness calibration exercise. So that is the overall aim. And of course, we're always faced with the reality, which is that in most cases, we would have a number of SPT test results and some triaxial tests, and we would have to derive a strength profile and then from that derive a stiffness profile. But we should be focusing more on the direct measurement of stiffness, which the best way to do that is in situ.
And I know a lot of your focus of the presentation was around economy and design. And I think a huge theme within the whole event was around efficiency and reducing carbon. And we're going to come to Alice in a moment, because that was the presentation she provided. But can you speak to our listeners a little bit about raft-assisted pile groups? Because that's something that we're seeing more of. We have touched on it in previous episodes, but I think the way you presented the idea was really good at the conference, and I think it bears repeating here.
Definitely. I think what we're finding now, because of the challenges of being able to get out of the ground as much as possible, the new emerging ways of design pile foundations is not a system that relies on a big factor of safety, but it's a system that is a hybrid system. So we're using piles that form part of a pile-assisted raft. And we have two main types. We have the raft-assisted pile system. So these are pile groups that have some contributions from the raft, but you also have the pile-assisted raft where the pile is picking up one portion of the load, and then the raft is the main foundation system. And in both cases, the designer is asked to effectively calculate what is the maximum shaft friction that the pile can mobilize before the load is transferred onto the raft. So therefore, the end bearing resistance, especially for piles and clay, it's not so critical. And in order to do that, we need to understand more the effective stress that is applicable, especially after excavation, and try to understand how piles perform at the serviceability condition, which is all about the mobilized stress at the safe open load. So what we're finding is with pile-assisted rafts, we can actually double the capacity of the pile simply because we rely on the pile fully mobilizing the shaft friction. So a pile that could normally carry 2 meganewtons now can carry 4 meganewtons before the load is transferred onto the raft without compromising the serviceability performance of the foundation. So that's a very powerful tool that we have to design. And what is missing just generally in the industry is good case studies showing the actual performance of pile-assisted rafts based on monitoring data, which was one of the topics I covered in the presentation.
Great. Well, I'm going to tie you up with Graham later, and we're going to have a little discussion around monitoring. So that'd be quite interesting. But just on that point, I think it'd be interesting to have a rule of thumb for our listeners. Is there certain situations, certain soil conditions where a piled raft works particularly well? I'm guessing if you, for instance, got a peaty soil down underneath your basement, it's not going to work, is it? Because the raft's not going to provide any extra bearing capacity.
Obviously, we're very fortunate with London clay in London in that it provides an ideal condition for a raft. And as long as if the ground condition is uniform and you're in good clay, it's a really good condition. And I would say the London conditions are ideal for a pile-assisted raft. And that allows also the design to be developed so that all the piles can be kept dry without any support fluid, which again is a big driver for the sustainability agenda and the carbon agenda. And if we are to optimize our foundations and reduce the amount of concrete and steel we're using, we just have to start designing foundations so that we can maximize the concrete stress. And the optimum way of doing this is to design a pile that can carry the maximum load that it can carry based on the concrete stresses and marry that load with the maximum load the pile can carry with the ground conditions. And you can achieve that with a pile-assisted raft very easily. So you're designing a pile to what we used to call in the piling industry the 0.25 FCU. And if you can maximize your concrete stresses, you can get the maximum benefit out of the concrete you're using in the pile.
Okay, well, on that note, I'll come to Alice, because Alice, your job is to reduce carbon in buildings that your clients come to you and they're looking for ways to provide a really environmentally friendly solution. Are you seeing that sort of technique employed on a lot of your new sites?
Yeah, I would say that piled rafts, so the other one where you have the piles and the raft is doing some bearing as well, are coming pretty commonplace. And we do have cases as well where we have that pile-assisted raft. I see that happening too. So where there is a raft and then there are some piles to limit the settlement, essentially, of the raft to something that is acceptable. And I think these are all good things. They come under the kind of the good design umbrella that we like to do anyway, and has the good benefit of also reducing the embodied carbon of our designs and reducing the cost of our designs. So I think clients like these kind of solutions. They are easy to explain. They take more design effort, potentially more site investigation, potentially, but the cost savings for the client are normally much, much greater than that, what's involved in working through it.
Yeah. And I know you've produced a model of the hierarchy. I mean, at the top, sorry, this is hierarchy of what you should do on the site. And at the top is don't build at all.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the most carbon efficient solution. We'd all be out of the job, of course, but ultimately, if we want to reduce carbon going into the environment, in the short term at least, that is the best way to do it. But do you want to talk through the other levels?
Yes. So the carbon hierarchy, reduction hierarchy, it goes from build nothing, so find an alternative way to get the same result that you're looking for, the same outcome, which might be reusing some existing foundations, for example. And then below that is build less. So I would say that things like your pile-assisted raft or your piled raft comes under that area rather than just doing it all on piles. You do more clever design and your design is more refined. So that reduces the amount of materials fairly easily. Below that, there comes build clever. So this is looking at things like maybe using the observational method to reduce the amount of temporary works. Probably the work that we do with the back analysis comes under there, although that enables then a build less in the future. And then below that is build efficiently. So that's looking at alternative materials, lower cement concrete, and also the use of electric powered construction plant that's been powered from a renewable source and things like that. But I'd like to challenge your comment that if we build nothing, we'll all be out of a job, because we need to be looking at whole life carbon. So we need to be looking at the carbon, the capital carbon, which we invest in whatever we're building. And then we need to look at the operational carbon, so the carbon associated with running the asset, and the user carbon, which is the carbon that asset having been built then influences. So this is really easy to think about if you think about highways. So I'm going to use a highways example, although this was the basements conference. So if you build a bridge across a river where everyone used to have to drive or get the train a really long way around, and now they can go straight across, although there's a capital carbon investment there, the actual whole life carbon has been reduced. So even the Build Nothing doesn't mean to say that we're out of a job.
Oh, that's good. Well, I'm happy to be challenged. You know, we're all on a learning journey, and I think particularly with these new and emerging technologies, where do you think the easy wins are for us in the construction? Because it feels like we're still pretty early in the journey. What can we do in the next 2 or 3 years that's going to make serious inroads into reducing carbon?
So I think some of the easy wins are things that we do already do and fall in that good design or better design category, where our designs are just more efficient. And we often end up with these when we are looking at things from a value engineering perspective anyway. And if you look at it from a carbon reduction perspective, you get similar, but perhaps not the same answer. There are some easy wins to be had in the short term in terms of concrete mixes, particularly in piling, where we don't necessarily need the strength to develop very fast. In fact, sometimes we prefer it to develop slowly. We're used to using quite large amounts of GGBS to replace cement and concrete. But GGBS is a finite and now dwindling resource, as there's more demand for it, and steel is now made in different ways.
Yeah, the Stuart Norman, sorry to interject there, Stuart Norman did a really good presentation on zero carbon concrete. I always find it a bit funny calling it zero carbon or
zero cement
concrete. Zero cement. Because when we're talking about GGBS and PFA as replacement products, of course, there has been a lot of carbon that's been generated in the process, but they're byproducts of other industries. What comes next? How do we replace GGBS? As you mentioned, you know, that's not going to be around forever. Where are we on the development curve of coming up with, I don't know, a polymer or some sort of recycled cement?
There are various different alternative cement mixes that are at different levels of development. I'd say there's no magic solution that's going to become the new concrete that will fix everything. As you say, they're still producing a construction material from raw materials or from waste materials that came from somewhere. And so there's still some carbon associated with them. There are some materials which would use carbon in the production process, but at the moment they're a very early stage and they're currently using commercially manufactured carbon. This is not, you know, at the moment a carbon capture and storage technology or anywhere from it. So I think all these things are good for the medium term because we need to attack on all fronts, but I'd still go further back up the hierarchy of carbon reduction. If you can eliminate a pile that's got zero carbon in it now, rather than having made it in a pile as a pile with 50% less carbon than your alternative.
That's wise words. But to get to zero carbon by 2050, as the nation hopes to, then as an industry, we need to come up with solutions to have completely different types of materials. And it's going to be really interesting to see exactly how we get there. You presented a case study, I suppose, of a platform box or example, rather than a case study, to consider the alternatives, a cost-benefit analysis, if you like, of how by changing the design of the project, you could potentially reduce carbon. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so this was a station box in London, which had been is located quite deep, and there was going to be a sprayed concrete line extension of the tunnel to make the platform tunnel. And because of the depth below the groundwater table and the geology that it ended up in, it was going to need probably ground freezing as ground improvement during that process. And so we looked at challenging some of the requirements about that had driven this box so deep, which is essentially limiting the ground movements and the impact on the buildings and infrastructure closer to the ground surface, and also the kind of risks of clashes for the tunnel boring machine in terms of existing foundations and so on. And by challenging some of those and raising up the station box into more favourable geology and having a smaller head of groundwater, you could switch the ground improvement technique to be dewatering, which is more tried and tested. And although I'm not sure anyone's worked through the maths in great detail, feels to me instinctively should use less energy over the life of the construction than doing ground freezing. And then it had the additional benefit that therefore the shafts you need at either end of the box for the passengers to get up and down are shorter. And actually the carbon saved in terms of just the concrete in the diaphragm walls and excavating and transporting away the soil in those shafts was fairly significant. So that's a nice example where there is a trade-off, because there would need to be more management of the stakeholders and control of the ground movements and the impact on all of the assets which are high, at ground level. But if you look at that in carbon terms, then you can actually maybe even open up a conversation with those stakeholders saying, well, your building is going to crack a bit more, but this is all the carbon that's being saved, and you know, we will patch it up, obviously. So yeah, I found that quite interesting that although we had done the study as a value engineering exercise, there were clear carbon savings that came out of it.
Okay. So would you say it's inherently more carbon efficient to have a building without a basement? So stick another two stories on the top instead of two stories below.
As a general rule of thumb, yes. Like all other things being equal, I would say yes. Sometimes we can't put another two stories on top. If it's a skyscraper, it may be, you know, a really tall building may be a different answer because there's a height above which they become less efficient. And if there are existing foundations or an existing basement, then taking advantage of that clearly changes that balance. And possibly if you get to a depth where you're balancing the weight of the soil removed with the weight of the new building and you have a raft foundation, again, it might be a different equation.
Yeah. It's not an easy answer, is it? Talking about basements, you mentioned the observational technique and potentially being able to take props out with the right instrumentation and reducing the construction program. One of the other lectures that I saw that I found really fascinating was that by a guy called Marco Di Mauro, who was on the instrumentation and monitoring side. And he was actually talking about artificial intelligence, and I think you could start to use monitoring within props and inclinometers to inform your decisions around what you're doing with the temporary work scheme. I think that sort of feeds nicely into our next guest, which is Graham Webb from WSP. I'm sure, Graham, you've had conversations with Marco on artificial intelligence. Where do you see that going, and how big a part? Again, I'm coming back to potentially doing myself out of a job when we look at artificial intelligence, but I'm sure the answer would be the same from you as from Alice, that there'll always be a place for engineers.
Yeah, I think that's right. I had a really interesting chat with Marco after his presentation about that and some of the things he was talking about, and his view that artificial intelligence is kind of what we call algorithms when we don't quite trust them yet. And sort of to start with, he almost sees them as, we just aren't adding an extra layer of supervision because your artificial intelligence tells you something, but then you still want to check that and get an engineer to look at it. But if you think back to other algorithms that we now use all the time, even something as simple as kind of sampling data and getting rid of outliers and sort of plotting trends, at one time that would have been done manually, but we've got algorithms that do that now, and we believe them, and we've kind of gone past the point of trusting that, and then that just sort of frees up the time of the engineers to focus on what they can do. And I think there's always going to be a place for engineers to add their judgment to it, and humans are really good at spotting where things are behaving slightly differently and trying to work out what's going on. And I'm not sure you'll ever replace that with algorithms. I think they're a sort of tool that we can add to our toolbox of techniques that we use to help us, rather than as something that's going to replace us.
The focus of your own presentation, certainly at the introductory stage, was on structural health monitoring, not a term that I was familiar with. Could you explain to the listeners a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's a fairly sort of broad term, and it's becoming more and more widespread. I mean, at the start of presentations, I've sort of thought about, well, what does structural health monitoring mean? And I think, in essence, it means putting some sensors on your structure or part of your structure, collecting a load of data and doing something with it. And there's lots of thoughts as to what that doing something with it could be. And I think that's the bit that the industry is really grappling with at the moment, really how to get value out of it. There's some parallels that people draw with other industries, like everyone's car's got warning lights that tell you when there's something wrong with it. Why can't our structures do the same if we instrument them and just tell us when a particular piece of repair work is needed? And the aerospace industry do very similar. And one of the key differences with our industry is most of what we build is a sort of one-off prototype. We don't build thousands of identical things like the car industry does. So it's much harder to work out when something's not behaving quite as it should.
Yeah. I was just having flashbacks to earlier in my career. So in my year in industry, I spent about 4 months with a structure engineer, and we did a little bit of monitoring of older buildings, and we'd go around and put these telltales up to look at cracks, mm-hmm. to see how quickly they were developing over time. I'm sure it's something that you've done and lots of other structural engineers will do in the future. But it struck me that is a very reactive form of monitoring, and actually what you're making the case for is being more proactive in assessing it. And how could we do that? What sort of tools have we got as engineers at our disposal to be proactive?
You make a very valid point, and it's certainly one of the uses of monitoring is once we've identified a source of a problem, we want to find something to help us manage that problem. But I think with developments in sensor technologies and monitoring techniques, there's more and more data available to us at covering kind of a much broader scale of things. I mean, the example you raise of telltales, it tells you something about a very specific point on a structure, but it's only any use if you've stuck it on that correct point that you're interested in. But we're seeing techniques develop, the sort of image-based processing techniques, which can look at movements over almost a continuum, and the satellite-based techniques that are becoming more and more widespread, just gives you an awful lot more data covering much wider sort of spatial coverage. And I think that's where I think there's really interesting potential for almost shifting the role around. So using the big data sets to identify where things are starting to behave slightly strangely, and then focusing the engineers on those, rather than what often happens the other way around, of the engineers spot something slightly funny going on and then use some data to refine what they know about it. So I think is just as a tool for sort of focusing our attentions. As we all know, engineers are stretched, and asset management organisations that have thousands of structures to look after, we do that in a fairly crude way still at the moment. I'm typically involved with bridges, but bridges are inspected every couple of years by some people going and looking around them. That's really labour intensive. That's really expensive. Some structures, you spot things that are going wrong. Other structures, nothing happens for decades. So is it really efficient use of engineers' time to go and look at a structure every 2 years when nothing's happened for the last 80? Perhaps we could be more intelligent around that. We could focus our efforts where things are actually changing rather than where they're not.
You mentioned the point about satellite imagery there, and I think it was the Miami collapse that we saw earlier in the year. They were talking about how satellite images had shown some movement within those structures over the years, and it's astonishing to think that satellite images could indicate, we're talking millimeters of movement. How's that even possible from outer space? Is absolutely extraordinary. But I don't know if that's something that was done retrospectively or something that they'd been collecting data on. Have you got any awareness of that
particular? I don't know detail of that example, but the sorts of satellites that have potentially of use to civil engineers, many of them are radar based, so they measure distance from the satellite to the ground, and there's various techniques that allow you to pick up movements of the ground to remarkable accuracies, as you mentioned, to millimeter scale. And these have been in existence for quite a while now, so it's another really interesting sort of feature of that technology, that there's archives of data that already exists, so you can look back in time quite easily. It's like someone installed the monitoring system 20 years ago, just covering most of the world. So you can do this sort of analysis retrospectively. It would clearly be more useful to do it sort of in real time and detect problems as they occur, and I think that's where it's moving, and examples like that are a really useful case study to sort of prove the technique, because you don't know where a problem is going to happen, so where to focus your efforts. But if you could use that kind of technique to identify where movements are happening, and that case sounds very similar to some of the work I've had some involvement with sort of scour monitoring, where again you sort of see telltale signs of movements happening before they become catastrophic. It gives you advance warning to be able to do something.
Yeah, and solution features in this country, of course, we've got various different areas of chalk in this country, where every other year we'll see a feature, you know, bus has disappeared down a hole, a house has disappeared into the ground. We also see it in areas where there's been mine working, and maybe that there could be something in place in the future that we are monitoring ground levels and there is some sort of alert system in place. I'm intrigued to know, actually, Graham, when you look at structures, and I'm sure you've examined lots of building failures, what are the common faults? Is it in the ground? Is it the geotechnical industry have failed in their part, or is it the way the thing's been put together, the structural design? What do you see any trends in that?
I think the most obvious one that comes to mind is drainage related. I mean, it's, I guess, coming a little bit back towards Demetrios's comments earlier around SLS and ULS, it's the sort of serviceability type failures of drainage that then accelerate deterioration. Because if you're on roads with de-icing salts, you get very high concentrations of chloride ions in the water that then sits in areas of the structure where it shouldn't. And that just causes problems with leading to deterioration of the reinforcement. And that's where a lot of structural problems start from. And that just leads to problems with movement joints, with expansion joints, with kind of structural details where they weren't anticipated, or it was never anticipated that they would be constantly exposed to water. So it's much more of a detailing thing where a lot of the problems seem to stem from than kind of outright problems with ground movements or with structural failures.
So that's presumably something that could be retrofitted. You could change those details so the building's not necessarily going to collapse if you catch it soon enough, and this is where the monitoring's important.
Yes, and it's with existing structures, that's the best you can do. With new structures, it feeds into the whole CDM regulations about thinking about maintenance, and you sometimes find with older structures, there's just not space to change very much, and if it hasn't been designed in from the start, it can be very difficult to retrofit, and then you're always on the back foot if you assume that your drainage is going to fail and design your structures to be more robust against that sort of failure. I think you're better in the long run.
You just mentioned there about Demetrios, and we'll bring him back in, because the part of his presentation was around the digital twins, and I wonder, Demetrios, what sort of monitoring are we talking about and instrumentation to help you build up that picture and that model? What have we got at our disposal?
I think obviously we're very fortunate these days in that we're getting so much useful monitoring data. For example, when we do a basement, we can monitor the lateral movement of the wall through in kilometers. We can get measurements of the heave in the ground using extensometers. We can monitor the capping beam movements with total station monitoring and relate that to the movement of the wall We can monitor also the movement behind the wall and relate that to a category damage assessment we do for third parties. There is so much monitoring that we can digitize and bring into the calibration of numerical models. And I guess the challenge would be to try to do it in a real-time way, in an agreed format, and also look at the movement of structures as a whole and not just isolated elements. So when we look at a typical pile test and we monitor the movement of a pile, I think the next challenge is to start looking at movements of, you know, pile groups, rafts, being able to actually see the response of real structures and see how hard are we really pushing the design and are we actually getting the response we are predicting in our models.
Yeah. There seems to have been a real shift in the last, I would say, 10 years in terms of ground movements. I barely ever came across a project where there was a ground movement assessment and a damage impact assessment. Now, maybe it's that there's more and more buildings that have got deep basements and next to railway embankments. Possibly that's part of it. But I think what's happened is the technology and our knowledge as an industry has improved and clients are starting to look towards these techniques of ways of managing their risk. And of course, monitoring will be part of that. So we are likely to see more inclinometers specified and pressure gauges on props and so on. And I think it's got to be a good thing. You know, we can drive efficiencies in what we do and raise the knowledge of our industry. I don't, the listeners can't see it, but you're nodding your head. So I'm guessing you've shared that experience.
Totally agree. And speaking to our colleagues from the instrumentation field, I understand they're working towards a standard format of information similar to the AGS we have for site investigation. So it would be amazing to have something similar for monitoring data and being able to capture that in an agreed way. Every time we have a complex basement, and we can use this data so that we can offer the maximum benefit to our clients. And I think especially in geotechnics, you know, going back to the early development of soil mechanics and the first conferences, there was always emphasis on how we can learn and improve from the behavior of real structures. And I think that should always be our key priority, just to learn from the behavior of real structures, simply because what we do is quite complex.
Yeah, there was a really interesting presentation actually from Mark Crichton from CGL, and I was lucky enough to chair that particular session. And he was dealing with a project in Marble Arch and looking at the way that the adjacent buildings would move, and they'd done a finite element analysis and they'd employed some monitoring. And it was interesting to compare and contrast the theory against the practice. In the end, they did end up with some slightly different values, which they put down to the foundations of the neighbouring structures being slightly deeper than they were expecting. But good use of technology. There was another project which was presented by Owen O'Meara from John Sis, where they'd used a lot of BIM techniques to help them visualise the development of the project and what equipment they could get into place. Again, brilliant stuff. I wonder, I'll open it up to all of our guests. Was there anything that particularly caught your eye over the course of the day on some of the other presentations?
There was for me. So there were the one that you haven't yet mentioned in the basements conference, which was Marylebone Square, where it was an entire block becoming the basement. And it was just something that caught my eye that it's a reminder for me as a designer when designing basements. We still often do some of our analyses in 2D, and we assume a level excavation sequence across the entire basement. You know, all the props go in at once, and then you dig down another level, and then all the props go in again. And it was a good reminder that is not what happens on sites, particularly big ones. You know, they like to start at one end and go to the other. And there's got to be some more clever stuff we can do in that area. Firstly, to make sure that the designers have accounted for that and allowed for that kind of construction. But then secondly, I feel like there must be some efficiencies we could do there if we could liaise with contractors earlier and understand their construction technique, because you've essentially got an enormous berm on one side already in position, and I don't think we ever take advantage of that in our design.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me about that one, Alice. That was also a really good presentation from the team from Kier. And I had a slightly different take from it, which was around the use of the plunge columns. And it came out through the Q&A, and I was asking Oliver and Trisha about how did you allow for the potential for there being an accident from a machine striking the plunge columns. And they came back with a really good answer. They managed the types of machines that were going down there. So as you can imagine, awful lot of weight supported by these plunge columns. And they said, well, we decided we're only going to use really small machines down there. So that limited the potential force that would be developed, and it wouldn't fail the supporting columns. So that was interesting. And we had a good discussion about the secant wall there and water tightness. So it was that was a really good one. Anything else from Graham and Demetrius?
I do. From the instrumentation and monitoring side, there were just several themes that kept cropping up in lots of people's presentations. One was artificial intelligence, which we've touched on already, and the other was kind of the trust of monitoring data and whether we believe it. And I'm sure many of us have had situations where there's been some monitoring going on for something we've been involved with, and the monitoring data shows that the behavior is not quite as you'd expected, and you start questioning, do we believe this data? Can we find a way of explaining that the data was wrong so that we can carry on? And it was just really interesting how many times this cropped up. If we're going to be using instrumentation to help us, we need to have confidence in the data that's coming from it. And kind of, I suppose, linked to the do we trust artificial intelligence. I mean, I think it's going to sort of happen gradually, but with new techniques, there's always a tendency to want to believe what your gut instinct is telling you rather than what the data is telling you if it's slightly different. And there's lots of things that feed into this. It's really hard to make predictions of what actually happens. As we all know, design predictions is one thing, but there's all sorts of uncertainty, and we sort of pick conservative assumptions to give us a safe answer. If we want to know the actual behavior of a structure, it's really difficult. And so it's not just the trust of the data you're getting, but the how confident you are in being able to make predictions that you can compare to that data and do something meaningful with. And so I think this is all of these questions kind of feed into the how do you get value out of your monitoring and thinking about what you're going to do with it, how you're going to use it to help you make decisions. And I think in many cases that sort of thinking doesn't happen early enough in the process, and that's one of the things I'm trying to convince people of and talk to people about, is planning through what you're going to do with your data and how it's going to influence your decision making needs to be one of the really early kind of conversations that needs buy-in from everybody, so that you then collect the right data, you've put enough thought into how much redundancy we need in the monitoring system so that we do have confidence in it and that we can actually use that output.
Well, you need an action plan, don't you? What are the trigger values? If I've got movement above this level, what do I do? Where does the information go? There's a lot of questions. When I speak to our clients, lots of people don't want props. So there might be a way to manage around that without compromising party wall agreements. Let's put some monitoring in place. But you've got to be ready to react to the situation where the movement from that basement wall is too much, and stop the excavation, get a prop in, and then carry on, because the consequences of these things going wrong are clearly huge.
Yeah,
Graham.
I was just going to say there's opportunities sort of the other side of that where of using less propping if you can show that it's not needed. So I think that sort of technique you can turn from a damage limitation exercise into a sort of opportunity to save on your construction process.
Demetrius, have I missed anything glaring that was a key point from the conference?
I was just going to say as well that in the same way that instrumentation is very important, I think we should also focus on capturing the construction activity. So a lot of times, we get some inclinometer data and we're just trying to understand why the movement is greater or less than what we predicted. But then a lot of the times the answer is because we need to know what happened on site. And in the same way we're capturing all these numbers about how much the wall is moving, we should be capturing what is happening on site, because that will give us the reason why the movement is taking place.
Now, we squeezed a huge amount of technical information into about 3/4 of an hour. I would encourage all of our listeners to attend the basement conference next year to get more of this. As well as all the brilliant presentations, I think one of the things, and I think everybody at the event shared this experience, it was just so amazing and wonderful to meet old friends and colleagues that we've probably not seen face-to-face for a long time. It was, I think, my first conference-type event for about 18 months, and it was brilliant to get back out there, and I really had a lot of fun at the event. So for those that did attend, thank you so much. Wonderful to see you. And thank you to all our guests today on this episode of the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve.
A couple of last little messages before I leave you. Thanks to everyone that has been in touch recently with some feedback about the podcast. Online at the basement event, at the FPS event, it's very much appreciated. Special mention to Paul Kelly from Dawson Wham and also Raul Perello Serrano from Coffee for their insights and ideas on future guests. Also, the Ground Forum Undergraduate Mentoring Program is now live for mentors and mentees. Go to the website, the Ground Forum website, to find out more and sign up. Potential mentors, my message to you is you can make a massive difference to shape the industry and a young person's life. Please help.